32 degrees. It's 10:06. This is WHYY.
I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Maybe some figgy pudding, eggnog, and a few days away from Washington will be enough for Congress and President Obama to reach an agreement on taxes and spending. If they can't meet their self-imposed deadline of January 1st, everyone's taxes will go up and automatic spending cuts will begin to go into effect. 2012 was dominated by the presidential election, and 2013 could herald in more fights about things like gun control, immigration, the federal debt, and how to sustain, even expand, economic growth. Meanwhile, there are a number of foreign policy challenges, including the civil war in Syria, Egypt's new constitution, the stalled Israeli-Palestinian peace process, the war in Afghanistan, Europe's troubled economy, and much, much more. Well, we have invited Dick Pohlman and Trudy Rubin to join us once again on Radio Times. Dick writes the National Interest blog for Newsworks website. That's WHYY's Newsworks website. Also writes the American Debate column in the Sunday Philadelphia Inquirer. And Dick Pohlman, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
And Trudy Rubin writes the Worldview column for the Philadelphia Inquirer. It runs on Thursdays and Sundays. She just got back from a trip to Turkey, Syria, and Egypt. Got back in the country just shortly before Thanksgiving. And Trudy, always a pleasure. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Lovely to be here.
Dick, let me begin with you, only because it looks like the President, Congress, going back to Washington, arriving today or tomorrow. Who do you think is going to blink first? And is that the appropriate way to think about these so-called debates?
Well, it's kind of depressing that we have to think in terms of blinking, because this is a financial crisis where you would think that there would be some level of cooperation, bipartisan agreement, everybody gives a little bit. But the problem we have right now, and it was evidenced by the end of last week, is that within the Republican Party, we have a sort of a never compromise, never see the other point of view cadre that won't even accept the notion of any kind of tax hikes on millionaires, which the House Speaker tried to get them to accept.
That was Plan B.
The so-called Plan B. And so, you know, here's a situation where the President took down his revenue target from $1.6 trillion to $1.2 trillion. He said he moved the goalposts so that the tax rate increases would be on people going from $250,000 a year up to $400,000 a year. Plus, there were a lot of spending cuts that he was offering that the Democratic left was getting upset about. And yet, I don't want to say the Tea Party contingent, but for shorthand, within the Republican Party is saying no to that. And so I think now we're at this crisis of governance, I think, that we're reaching now. So to the point where, you know, it's like if you can't raise taxes on millionaires, It's like everybody has to get their taxes raised.
But do you think Wall Street will have to step in? And by that, I mean Wall Street will take a big tumble if they can't do this deal?
Well, I mean, I guess theoretically that could happen. What's interesting to me was – it's interesting, after that Plan B failed last week and everybody went home for Christmas with nothing accomplished, the Dow just fell just a little bit, actually. So, I mean, I think there's actually a feeling that on Wall Street that they do think that there's going to be some kind of a combination at the end. But, unless Republicans can get these House people to move, we're heading into the new year with this fiscal cliff going. You know, there's a possibility that Boehner could perhaps get some kind of a cobble together, some kind of deal with the White House and maybe with the Senate Republicans that would require a lot of Democrats in the House to combine with maybe the more sane Republicans to get something through. But we'll have to see.
Just one more thing before I get to you, Trudy, which is the CBO said that if they couldn't come to some kind of agreement within the next couple of months, and maybe that's being pessimistic, the concern was that the recession would be back and unemployment would go up.
Well, I think that's the danger. That's the danger. And so then the question is, I mean, politically, who gets blamed? And I think what's very interesting, what's really kind of depressing in some respects, is that, you know, we had Obama won the election. By at this point, you know, almost 5 million votes. The Democrats won the aggregate House vote nationwide by over a million votes. They won the aggregate Senate votes nationwide by over 10 million. And every poll that's come out in the last month has said that if the fiscal cliff thing is not resolved, that the Republicans are going to get the brunt of the blame, not the president. And so yet we're in this situation where there are a number of House Republicans who don't particularly care about that because they're in very, very safe House districts.
Because of redistricting.
Deep red districts. And so they're sort of walled off from that kind of impact. And so, you know, that's the crisis of governance.
Trudy, it's almost unfair to ask this because you just got back from Turkey, Syria, and Egypt. You've been to Afghanistan. You've been to Pakistan, the Middle East, various hotspots around the world. Dick was describing some of the domestic challenges facing the country. What do you think is the number one foreign policy challenge facing the country?
I think the most immediate challenge that's coming up is going to be with Iran because the Israeli prime minister, who is slated to win elections in January and become prime minister again, all the polls indicate, it has said at the United Nations in the fall that May or June is the point by which the red line, by which Iran would clearly have the capability for a weapon, and Israel would act alone if the United States didn't want to go with them in attacking their nuclear sites. Now, one has to say that red lines have been set before and passed, so this doesn't mean it will happen, and there's a lot of speculation, will it, won't it, and there are a lot of senior intelligence people in Israel, including past heads of their Mossad, their overseas intelligence agency, who think that it would be an extremely bad idea to attack now, and really bad if the United States wasn't alongside Israel for many reasons. But the president is going to have to deal with that. There's a possibility that some talks with Iran may start in the next month, but it's not at all clear. And if they did start, they might just be a stalling action. So I think that's going to be one of the big issues coming up very soon. This is also the key year. The United States is slated to withdraw from Afghanistan at the end of 2014. Big decisions on how fast to pull out the remaining 60,000 plus troops. And Syria. Syria is a really big issue because the U.S. officials, the State Department, made a big push a few weeks ago to set up effectively an alternative Syrian government, but not much has been done to enable this group to funnel, say, money in for humanitarian relief inside Syria. The situation is horrendous for civilians. The regime is using cluster bombs. They're using phosphorus. They're using the most hideous kinds of weapons against civilians, and nobody really knows what's going to happen, and the United States doesn't have much leverage, and jihadis are gaining, from my perspective, in large part because the U.S. is so absent. And I don't mean absent in terms of boots on the ground, which there won't be, but in terms of a strategy for dealing with Syria. So, you know, and then there's the repercussions of the Arab Spring in Egypt and so forth. So there's many things on his plate.
The headlines today, a Syrian general whose name I will not butcher on the air, but who led the military police has reportedly defected to the rebels, talking about joining the People's Revolution. I'm not sure this is exactly confirmed, but another defection in Syria seems to me has some significance.
The problem is that there's basically a stalemate, and it seems as if the only thing that will end that stalemate, because the rebels can't take Damascus, and they've been fighting for Aleppo for 6 months, and basically half the city has been destroyed, but they still haven't taken it. So the question is, will you have some kind of international negotiated settlement, everybody's dream, but an unlikely hope? Or will something tip the balance? The U.S. has been unwilling to aid certain factions of the opposition. The argument is that weapons like anti-tank or anti-aircraft would fall into the wrong hands. But in the meantime, the most Islamist militia groups are getting those weapons from Saudi Arabia, from other Gulf states, or they are capturing caches of Syrian army weapons. And so, ironically, by holding back, the U.S. is enabling the Islamists to gain traction on the military side. And, you know, by sort of standing there paralyzed, the U.S. is neither helping to turn the military balance nor helping to organize the non-Islamists, and the negotiating option is really not there. So something bad will happen in Syria this year, and the U.S. won't have much influence.
Let me toggle back to you, if I could, Dick Pullman, and this is a little bit jarring, but you had a piece recently about the second term curse. And obviously, President Obama, as you described, and as we know, won re-election. Looking back at some former presidents, sometimes second terms can be problematic terms. I'm not predicting here, but something to keep in mind.
Well, what's the slogan on one of the buildings in Washington? What's past is prologue. You had, you know, Reagan had the Iran-Contra. Clinton had the Lewinsky scandal. Nixon had Watergate. You can go on and on and on. And partly it's because I don't know, the presidents tend to run out of steam, or their staffs turn over, and the second term people aren't as good as the first term people, or the electorate gets tired of the president, and the opposition feels emboldened because the president's a lame duck as soon as he wins re-election. So all these factors come into hand. Were you about to pose a follow-up question on that?
Oh,
okay.
No, go ahead.
So the prospects for Obama, I mean, Obama keeps saying, and he has said this recently, you know, that he's very, very aware of history. He's a student of history. Of course, Nixon said the same exact thing right after he got reelected by a landslide.
But Nixon is different from Obama, would you say?
Oh, yeah.
From what we know.
Now, there's a real sleight of hand parallel that a lot of people wouldn't want to hear me say. But just in terms of that particular dynamic. But the thing that we need to watch for, of course, and I alluded to this before in terms of the House Republicans, is that, you know, it's not just up to the president what he's able to do. It's also the other political factors that he has to deal with. And, you know, the Republicans still have one chamber. There's still a lot of people in there who really still do not accept him as a legitimate leader, even though he's beaten them twice by more than 50% of the vote. So, you know, it's going to put an enormous amount of pressure, I think, on him to try to find ways to negotiate. Mm. The problem is that negotiation really hasn't gotten him very far. So, you know, this is not like I love the Lincoln movie.
I was just thinking of the Lincoln movie.
Right. Everybody in the Senate and the House had to go see it.
For the 13th Amendment.
For the 13th Amendment. It's terrific to see him do it, and he's very, very shrewd about it. But, you know, the factors were a little bit different there. You know, I don't know if you had the same kind of intransigence that basically you're seeing now, where, you know, then there was enough people that were, he was able to pick off enough people who, either by threats or patronage or whatever, there is no such thing as that kind of patronage anymore. You know, he doesn't have that. You know, if he was to threaten to take pork away from them, but pork is a bad word now, and the opposition would probably demonize what he was trying to do. So he has a very, very narrow window, I think, for success the next 18 months.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation, talking with Dick Pullman and Trudy Rubin about domestic and foreign issues, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. What for you the high points, low points of 2012? What do you want for 2013? 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art proudly supports WHYY and presents Art After Five, a blend of jazz and international entertainment every Friday. This Friday features a New Year's Eve pre-party at the museum. The countdown to 2013 is on with celebratory holiday cocktails, festive attire, and dancing in the Great Stair Hall, with classic holiday doo-wop, rock and roll, and soul with Matthew Piazzi and the Debonairs. Beginning at 5:45, more details are available at philamuseum.org.
2012 has been a year filled with complex events. From the Jersey Shore in Delaware to Center City in Princeton, WHYY is proud to cover the stories that matter to you through our in-depth local news services, Newsworks Tonight, Radio Times, and Newsworks.org. Each illuminate what matters most to you. Help us cover the next important story. Make your year-end tax-deductible gift to WHYY. Visit whyy.org/support.
This week on This American Life, when Adam was a kid, Christmas was magical. In his family's house, he and his siblings could hear but never see Jekko the Elf. They met a mysterious Christmassy figure named Klaus Hofer and Kris Kringle.
He broke out one bone, and he said, "This is one of the bones from the, you know, the original Rudolph. You know, I use it to call the reindeer."
Lights, camera, Christmas, this week.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Trudy Rubin. She writes the Worldview column for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and it runs on Thursdays and Sundays. As I said earlier, she got back from a trip to Turkey, Syria, and Egypt earlier this fall. Dick Pullman writes the blog called National Interests for WHYY's Newsworks website. He also has a Sunday column in the Philadelphia Inquirer called American Debate, and we are talking about politics and foreign policy today on Radio Times. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Trudy, President Obama has nominated John Kerry to be the next Secretary of State. I'm not sure how many miles Hillary Rodham Clinton has logged as Secretary of State, but it might be a record breaker. Nonetheless, what do you make of her term as Secretary of State?
You know, Hillary Clinton is a very impressive, charismatic person, as the country has seen. And I think that within her brief, she has really been very impressive. This has been a Secretary of Stateship that was very much constrained by President Obama's desire to set all the parameters himself. Foreign policy was really run from the White House. So as a result...
Is that unusual?
No, I think it varies by the president. You know, you might have a President Nixon who lets Kissinger go out, and or H.W. Bush, who really gave a large brief to Secretary of State James Baker. In this case, Hillary Clinton was not in a position to create a doctrine or set parameters. She had some things that really concerned her, the status of women, children. She did some wonderful things there. She did a lot of reorganizing in the department. And when she was given a free run, I have seen how she was able to operate in Pakistan and Afghanistan, where she has a terrific political touch. So, for example, in Pakistan, at a very dicey period, she came in, she addressed student groups who were screaming, yelling, very hostile, and by the time they left, she had bounced things back at them, not in an ugly way, but in a challenging way. And by the time it was over, they were eating out of her hand. They may still have been anti-American, but she managed to get them into a discussion. She has a brilliant political touch.
But is that the... That's diplomacy.
That's diplomacy. It is diplomacy. What kind of a Secretary of State she would have been if she had a different mandate from the White House, we'll never know. One gives her great marks for being out there in the world, for making a terrific impression, for the areas that she cared about. But doctrine, that was not her mandate to set.
I almost hate to ask this because we're talking about 4 years hence, but nonetheless, there's, of course, talk about Hillary Rodham Clinton as running for president. Thoughts about that? Is it stupid to even begin having that discussion now?
Well, you know, it's funny because when I speak to groups, I get two questions, and they're contradictory. First is, why are our campaigns so long? And, and the second one is, do you think Hillary Clinton's going to run in 2016?
Exactly.
And it comes from the same kind of people.
I think I've asked those two questions probably of you, but yes, go ahead.
Well, you know, it's funny. I had I hosted at Penn recently. I had a guest speaker named Sally Bedell Smith, and she's a biographer. And she did a biography a Bill and Hillary biography a few years ago. And during the event, question and answer period, I asked her, I said, so what do you think? From what you know of Hillary Clinton, do you think she's running next time? And she said, she insisted that Hillary Clinton wants to run, and that Bill is a very strong influence on her, and he really thinks it's important. He wants it for her. He probably wants it for him, too, on some level. And So she is, at least in terms of the pack, you know, she's you know, she's the one that basically preempts the pack if she wanted to get in. Question is, you know, I mean, I think Trudy can probably speak to this better than I can, but from everything indication I have, she's pretty exhausted and would love to take a year or two to sort of recharge her batteries and, I don't know, hang out at a think tank or be a president of some college or whatever. You know, she doesn't have to do anything for a while. I mean, the point is that as soon as she did decide to do something, there would be an infrastructure there and people would be ready to go. So it's really, I mean, part of it might come down to, you know how Obama's doing. You know, at that point in time, you know, I mean, because there's a little bit of a spillover, I think, with the public, is if they're feeling good about the Democratic administration going out, would they feel receptive about another one coming in?
Trudy, let me ask you something. I'm not sure if anyone knows the answer to this. This goes back to the attack on the consulate in Benghazi in Libya. Susan Rice appears on all those Sunday talk shows, and I watched some of them, and I kept asking myself, why isn't Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton on these talk shows, because, you know, that falls under her responsibility. I don't quite understand what the Obama administration was thinking or what the strategy was. I mean, I think it backfired, but nonetheless, what are your thoughts?
You know, the whole story of Benghazi drives me crazy, because although it was clearly a very serious event where an ambassador was killed, it was blown up into something that it absolutely never should have been. I don't know why Hillary Clinton wasn't sent out there. I mean, there's been stuff written. She didn't want to do it. She was exhausted, blah, blah. I don't blame her for not doing it. And maybe it was something that should have been handled by somebody at a lower level. It's confusing to know why Susan Rice handled it the way she did. She did speak from talking points. She did qualify them. If you go back and you look at the transcripts, and I saw some of her appearances, but, you know, there were factors there that have just been expanded out of mind. I mean, for example, this was a mid-level, there were two factors here. One, on the State Department side, it was a mid-level bureaucratic problem. There was hesitation, probably for financial reasons, because Congress has cut back on budgeting for security. And so people are trying to husband money. This was not a formal consulate. The consulate hadn't even been built yet. The second factor was CIA. Benghazi was mainly a CIA station. The CIA was involved here, and ex-General Petraeus. They, in the beginning, didn't want a lot of publicity given to this because they didn't want to advertise that this had been a major CIA station. So that was a factor in it, and possibly the reason why the briefing that she got from intelligence agencies downplayed things. And then there was a third factor, which we'll never fully know about, which is why did the ambassador go there, in knowing the security situation? Right. And part of that is that he was an ambassador who always wanted to be out there, and he was going to inaugurate some cultural program. Well, think about that. If he thought the security was so bad there, why was he going with a minimal protection? Because he thought Benghazi was his. He had been very involved with Benghazi. He thought he knew the situation. So this is not some conspiracy by the White House at the highest levels. It reminds me back in Africa in the late 90s, you recall that our embassies in Kenya and Tanzania were blown up with large loss of life. The ambassador there, Prudence Bushnell, had complained many times to the State Department about lack of security. She hadn't gotten what she needed. When those embassies were blown up, with scores of people killed, it wasn't the White House that was accused of a conspiracy. It was a mid-level blockage, and that one didn't even involve the CIA. So, you know, maybe Hillary didn't think it required her presence, but what disturbs me much more is how this was blown up beyond the tragedy that it really was.
And that's Trudy Rubin, who joins us along with Dick Pullman. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499, talking about domestic issues and foreign policy issues and challenges. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-WHYY. Dick, just jumping off of that, I mean, is everything now a fight in Washington? Is everything just going to be a big fight?
Yeah, I mean, we're stuck with this. You know, as a matter of fact, Benghazi is a perfect example, because we still have House hearings, still Republican House hearings, trying to sort of get to the bottom of, allegedly to the bottom of, what they sort of perceive to be a possible, you know, White House conspiracy. Hillary Clinton's illness the last couple weeks is being seized upon as being not a real illness, that she's trying to avoid being questioned. So, you know, they've had the first term, you know, they were looking for, they've been frustrated by the lack of scandals, I think. You know, they had, Republicans had Solyndra for about 2 seconds, and they had Fast and Furious and the Mexico gun-running thing for a couple months, and they didn't really amount to anything. So they're looking for this. I mean, there's one comment posted on my column this morning, on my National Interest blog this morning, and it says, this is about me. when will Pullman mock Hillary's fake illness concussion excuse so that she wouldn't have to testify on Benghazi? Where is the follow-up on her condition from our so-called watchdog media? What a laugh, absolutely pathetic.
I get this email too. Uh-huh. You know,
not that specific.
No,
one,
not that specific. But you know, why aren't you investigating this conspiracy? You know, the saddest thing is that, as I mentioned, a large part of the confusion over this was probably due to the intelligence agencies wanting to play down the significance of Benghazi as a watching post for the travel, you know, all these arms that were unprotected in Libya. This was the watching post for weapons being shipped out illegally of the country and for militia groups. And the intelligence agencies, you know, didn't want a lot of publicity. Mm.
Well, talking about arms, let's talk about guns. The tragic shooting in Newtown, Connecticut. Everyone has had their funeral now, but it is, you know, still frankly shocking to think about what happened there. The president went to Newtown and talked about the tragedy there, said that his administration was going to do something about gun control last Friday. Wayne LaPierre, the vice president for the NRA, went on television and gave his speech about guns, basically saying that all schools should be armed, and that's the way we're going to protect children from these mass shooters. Do you think, and Dick Pullman, you had an interesting piece recently about, I guess when you were a much younger journalist, going down to Washington to interview the NRA, to mm-hmm. find out sort of what their thinking was and what their policy thinking was, and do you see any is it the same NRA that you interviewed a couple of years ago as the one today?
Yeah, much younger, much younger. We're talking 27 years. And I think that's basically, it's the same basic sensibility, which is that, you know, you can't give, this is their thinking, that you can't give on anything, because if you give on anything, that it's a slippery slope and you're going to slide to the bottom, and at the bottom it is that the government's going to confiscate everybody's guns. And, you know, it to me it defies logic to think, first of all, there's 300 million or however many guns out there. They're not going to come back. So anything that we're talking about now in terms of reform is really just going to affect, hopefully on the margins, but hopefully for the better, the availability of certain kinds of high-capacity ammunition and high-capacity semi-automatic weapons. And you know, I think part of the problem is the term gun control, by the way. Right. You know, I think gun control has become this pejorative for taking everybody's guns, controlling guns. You know, but, you know, sensible gun reform seems to be the way that you can frame this thing. And I also said on Monday that I wrote here on Monday in Newsworks that it's a money issue here, when the NRA says let's arm everybody and let's arm all 99,000 public schools, that's a terrific growth market to sell more guns, you know, to people who would be supposedly arming them. And, you know, that's really what the NRA is in the business for. They're in the business for their clients, the gun industry. It's a $12 billion industry. And the NRA is a $250 million a year lobby. And what's good for one's good for the other.
But what's interesting is when you dig down a little bit, and we're going to do a show tomorrow on guns and gun safety. I think that's the phrase I've heard as well. Is a lot of members of the NRA want sensible gun control. It's it seems like the leadership represents one portion of the NRA, but the membership is at least majority from what I've seen, Dick.
Right. Well, different. It's yeah. I mean, Wayne LaPierre, their vice president, he was on Meet the Press on Sunday, and he was saying that you know, that we speak for 4 million members who, you know, but they don't necessarily speak for a lot of those people. A lot of the members are people who, you know, who go hunting, and they don't, they know they don't need a bushmaster, as it's called, you know, to blow away animals with repeated rounds. The bushmaster was that same weapon from Newtown was the one that was used by that convicted felon up in Webster, New York, to kill two firefighters just the other night.
Let me get hold on 1 second. Let me get Tom from Homely, PA, to join us. And Tom, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome.
My question is, picking up on what you just said, could President Obama have issued an executive order the day after the shootings in Newtown? Because we've seen the sale of these guns continue, and they will continue until Vice President Biden's commission brings whatever information forth it has. Could that have happened?
Well, that's a good question.
Yeah,
you know, I'm, some executive orders, you know, are workable. Some executive order. I mean, if you had an executive order that perhaps just sort of peremptorily cut off interstate commerce, I don't know how. I think that would probably be challenged in court on day one, and perhaps I can see a federal judge perhaps enjoining that pending further argument. I think that would have been pretty tough to do. And so I think he's in a tough position on the gun issue, Obama is, because, you know, he only has X amount of political capital. He's fighting these serious fiscal fights right now. We've been talking about the immigration battle, which we haven't talked about yet. That's going to come up. He's going to have to expend on that. And it's tough to take on. It's tough to take on the gun issue because
it's complicated.
Yeah. Well, again, you know, you've got to get it through Congress, and the NRA terrifies a lot of lawmakers.
Go ahead, Trudy. Thanks, Tom, for the call.
One of the interesting things about this gun issue is the comparisons with overseas. And there's so many interesting factoids here. I mean, for example, not only do we by miles and miles have the most per capita guns in the world, and there's 270 million approximately guns in this country, but the next two countries way, way below us in per capita gun use are Yemen and Iraq. Yemen is second. Iraq is fifth. And I've never been in Yemen, but I have been in Iraq. And people have a gun in their home because they fear for their life and there's no security. There's only roaming militias. And so what amazes me, I got an email this morning from South Dakota. My column runs around the country. And they said, you obviously don't love your family because you don't want a gun to defend them. And I guess there's a lot of people who feel like they're living in Iraq or Yemen. Why? I'm not sure. But don't trust their police. Don't trust their government. And it's really tragic. The other example that I think is informative is Australia. I mean, that's a rough and ready country with a big hinterland, a lot of hunters. They had a terrible massacre in 1996 in a place called Port Arthur, where somebody with a repeating rifle shot 35 tourists, and he picked them off one by one. He just kept shooting. And after that, they immediately passed legislation. They bought back 600,000 guns, mostly heavy-duty, repeating, and they limited them. And there's never been a massacre since.
Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation, covering a lot of territory today on Radio Times with Trudy Rubin and Dick Pullman, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Yannick Nezet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra present a New Year's Eve celebration at the Kimmel Center, featuring favorites of the Strauss family, complete with dancers and plenty of surprises. The concert starts at 7:30, and you'll be home by midnight. New Year's Eve tickets at 215-893-1999 or online. this Monday, December 31st, New Year's Eve at the Kimmel Center with Yannick Nézet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Wherever you live, whatever you're into, Newsworks.org has you covered. Whether it's insightful reporting on Philadelphia city life, New Jersey politics, or small wonders in Delaware, you're covered. Lovers of the arts, health and science, looking for something unique? You guessed it, covered. Repairing your carburetor? Okay, maybe not everything. But for solid journalism and thought-provoking discussion, choose WHYY's Newsworks.org. Smart. Local. News. Covered.
On the next Fresh Air, we begin a holiday week series featuring a few of our favorite interviews of the year. On day one, it's our interviews with Joan Rivers and Aziz Ansari. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, I'm talking with Trudy Rubin. She writes the Worldview column for the Philadelphia Inquirer. It runs on Thursdays and Sundays. She has traveled to just about all the hot spots in the world in her long career as a journalist. Dick Pullman with us as well. Writes a blog called National Interest for WHYY's Newsworks News and Dialogue website. Also has a Sunday column in the Philadelphia Inquirer called American Debate. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Dick, I know you wanted to add one more thing.
Oh, just briefly on, because yes. Trudy was talking about factoids on guns. One of my favorites is that this is on the issue of video games, which the NRA is blaming video games a lot for our cultural violence. And the stat I saw was that Japan, where video games are extremely violent, video games are extremely popular, that Japan averages about 11 gun-related murders a year, and the United States has about 11,000 gun-related murders a year. At least that was the 2008 figure. So, the correlation there is a little bit specious, and it's also complicated, I think, by the fact that New York Times had a great story on this yesterday, actually, that the gun industry and the NRA as well has deals with video games to put out violent video games, and there's there's mutual financial interest there, so
synergy.
Synergy, which on Friday they were denying apparently even exists.
But I wonder, based on all that you have said, but also again looking at polls, almost hate to do that as well, but looking at polls and perhaps even looking at what happened in Newtown, Connecticut, it seems to me that there are reasonable regulations. It's not going to solve everything, but at least can register guns, fill in some of these gaps within the system, training courses. The sort of basic rules and regulations that it seems to me most law-abiding people would agree to.
Well, first of all, one always should come back to, and I'm sorry there hasn't been more publicity to it, the fact that most policemen want a ban on semi-automatic weapons. Secondly, we had a ban and it was allowed to expire. So we don't need to go somewhere new. We can start there, plus with registering secondary purchases at gun shows. So yes, there are steps that clearly could be taken that don't affect hunters, that don't affect people who have some legitimate fear and want a gun in their home. And they're out there. We know what needs to be done. It's just the politics.
You mentioned immigration, Dick, and let me just toss this right back at you. Also looking at the sort of minority country that we are becoming, the powerful Hispanic vote in November of this year, do you see that there might be some progress on immigration, and again, finding some middle ground that a majority of people can agree on?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think a majority of Americans, if we were talking about polls a second ago, majority of Americans, I think, feel that some kind of path to citizenship law would be a good idea and a smart idea and a logical idea. The question is, again, can it get through the Republican House? And that would require, of course, obviously a lot of Democratic support. Most Democrats would support it. But it would also require some support from, I guess, what would be a dirty word these days, the more moderate Republicans in the House. And it's really a question first of all, it's making it workable, but it can be done. I mean, Ronald Reagan, who is still, of course, you know, the true north for Republican conservatives, you know, Ronald Reagan signed off on some kind of quote unquote amnesty law back in the mid 1980s, and there's no reason that something like that can't be done again. The question really is: are enough Republicans willing to face the fact that, frankly, they're going to continue to, in their own self-interest, that they're going to, if they don't support something like this, they're going to continue to get hammered by the fastest growing electorate in America, which are, as you said, Hispanics. I mean, Obama won Colorado, Nevada, Florida, and probably others I'm like not thinking of right this moment, in part because of a very strong Hispanic turnout in his favor. And these are, you know, this is a demographic reality that, you know, the smarter Republican strategists recognize and are being very vocal about.
But what's interesting, and President Bush tried to come up with some kind of common sense immigration reform and was then unable to do that as well.
Yeah. Well, that was at least in our recent history, that was the turning point where we realized that Republican conservatives sort of being sort of a border security conscious were just sort of moving too far to the right for anything like reform to pass, because it was President Bush got something like 44% of Hispanic voters in 2004, which is, you know, the high watermark, and could be for a very long time for Republicans. But in 2006, 2007, he tried to get something through the Senate, and it died. And John McCain, who was a very, very strong advocate for path to citizenship reform, then turned on a dime when he saw where the tea leaves were going, and he was trying to win the nomination in 2008. And he was kind of like, you know, in some ways the barometer for how that sentiment changed. So it's really, you know, can the base of the party, which booed immigration reform in any form during the debates in the last year or two, can the base of the party move on that to the for the greater good of the party?
We have mentioned John Kerry, Hillary Clinton earlier, Trudy, and it looks like John Kerry will be the next Secretary of State. Chuck Hagel's name has been floated out as well as a possible Secretary of Defense. Now, there's some, I won't even use the word controversy, but some questions, I guess, being raised about him. What do you make of a possible Kerry-Hagel duo?
When you think about it, it would be very interesting that you would have two Vietnam veterans of a certain age, both of whose ideas about U.S. intervention have been heavily colored by their deep experience in the Vietnam War, and both of whom have had most of their careers in the legislative field, although Hagel also ran a business, and so he has some management experience. The controversy over Hagel has basically erupted over something he said in an interview a while back to a former State Department official, now at a think tank, named Aaron David Miller, in which he talked about the Jewish lobby and its influence. And this has erupted into charges that Hagel is anti-Semitic. Now, people who know Hagel, and also if you look at his writings, it's clear that he is not anti-Semitic. He was referring to the pro-Israel lobbying group AIPAC. And in fact, in the Israeli press, AIPAC is often referred to as the Jewish lobby. A columnist just did it recently in Haaretz. It's shorthand. It's probably a phrase that he shouldn't have used because to many people it's loaded. But the point is, can you be critical of policies of an Israeli government and without being accused of being anti-Semitic? And many people feel that the charges against Hagel are really a smokescreen for people who are upset at Obama because he in the past has not seen eye to eye with the present Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu. So the question is this enough to sink his? But Hagel's very iconoclastic, independent-minded. He's also spoken out very strongly on negotiations over military action. When it comes to Iran, he thinks there should be negotiations with Hamas. Now, you can disagree with some of those ideas, but one has to remember that foreign policy in this administration mm-hmm. will be set in the White House. And some people think that because of his military experience, Hagel might be a good person to have to preside over an era in which cuts will be made in the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. And the question is, do you have somebody who understands their needs and can make these cuts wisely?
Let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. It looks like we have Enoch from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Enoch, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I just wanted to remind your guests and your listeners that the intended purpose of the Second Amendment had absolutely nothing to do with hunting. It was explicitly written to ensure a state free from oppressive government. And if the citizens don't have access to semi-automatic weapons or high-capacity magazines, the government will have a monopoly on force. And then we will have no other option but to trust them. And I believe history has been pretty pretty obvious that politicians and governments in general aren't always trustworthy.
Don't leave us.
Okay. Yeah.
So do you think the government is the enemy?
I don't think they're
the enemy of the United States?
No, not at all. I just think that gradually, as governments amass more powers, they generally attract people who are seeking power. And
who are you talking about? I'm curious about who do you think is doing that?
I just think that the majority of people who go into politics, a lot of them aren't trying to, you know, help the world. A lot of them have power complexes they're seeking to exercise.
And do you think people that amass lots of guns, including the man that shot the firefighters up in New York, do you think he was on a power trip as well?
Yeah, I do believe he was exercising some need to, show power, but obviously...
Show power against firefighters?
I'm not sure. I don't know what his, what his motives were. Mm-hmm. He was obviously deranged.
Do you think we should get guns out of deranged people's hands?
I do. I think there should be a lot more, mental health restrictions as far as gun ownership goes.
And firefighters, either they're volunteer or they work for city or local governments. They're part of our government.
Yes, they are. But they aren't attracted. They are actually trying to help people. They're not. What do politicians do? Most of the time they sit around and talk and schmooze, and what is their actual contribution to society? A fireman, you can measure their contribution.
Well, it's interesting you say that, Enoch, and let me get, I'm looking at you, Dick Pullman. Sounds like maybe one of the people that writes to your blog.
I think it's somewhat contradictory, say, for the NRA to make a similar argument that our caller just made about the threat of having a government having all the guns, I guess, when in fact the NRA's proposal to put armed police in 99,000 public schools is in essence putting more weapons in the hands of government.
In fact, I think Ron Paul has come out against...
I think Ron Wayne Paul actually, from the libertarian perspective, spotted that contradiction.
For
yes.
that very reason. Go ahead, Trudy.
I don't think it would be a better idea to put guns in the hands of armed volunteers, which also had been suggested. What the caller said, it seems to me, indicates that he and perhaps a lot of other people think that police forces and the U.S. military are who most Americans seem to think are heroes, the National Guard, are all our enemies. Because if the idea is to raise militias who are armed with military-style weapons, who are they going to be fighting about? They're not going to march on Washington and shoot up the Congress. So is the idea that they should have military-style weapons to fight the police? I think that's a reason why the police are against military-style weapons. I don't think that this is what the Founding Fathers had in mind. They lived in a different time.
Indeed. But Dick, I wonder whether Enoch's call touches this strain of anti-government sentiment that I don't think there's anything new about it. Perhaps it's more vocal and outspoken now, but but that somehow the government is the enemy.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and we've had elected officials who have talked that way.
Well, you know, what disturbs me most about that shooting in Webster, New York, from the shooter being deranged, as the caller just said, what disturbs me about that is that he sets fire to these buildings and he knows that the first people that come out are going to be first responders, and they're symbols of authority. They're authority figures on some level. And, you know, to look at them in that light, through that kind of abstraction, you know, is horrifying, because they're people with families who ended up having, you know, the worst, the most horrific Christmas of their lives.
Indeed. Go ahead,
and
Trudy.
I think that it really is sidetracking the debate to talk about help for the mentally ill, which is an issue unto itself. But, for example, the same day that Newtown took place, there was a deranged person in China, a presumably deranged, who went into a school and stabbed 22 children. Now, they all survived. It's not that we, you know, prefer stabbing children, but the point is there's very severe gun control of a type that nobody is proposing here. But in China, nobody could get a military-style rifle and go in and shoot those children.
I hate to – we only have a minute. I'm trying to figure out how to sort of wrap everything up, but perhaps I'll go back to you, Dick Pullman, which is looking ahead. Do you see 2013 as – another contentious year? We've talked about a lot of contentious issues during this hour.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's terrible because I had a trivia quiz, which I had in the paper, but I also expanded on it in my blog today. And the last question I said was, true or false, so President Obama's victory in 2012 is going to usher in a new era of comity, C-O-M-I-T-Y, and bipartisanship in Washington. And in the answer section, it basically says, oh, please, you know the answer to that already. So I can't improve on that. I'm sorry.
Well, we will end on that note. Always appreciate the fact that we can chit-chat with the both of you. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
Welcome. You're welcome. Dick Pullman blogs at National Interest for the WHYY's NewsWorks website, and he's also has a column in the Sunday Inquirer called American Debate. And you can read Trudy Rubin's Worldview column in the Philadelphia Inquirer on Thursdays and Sundays. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you for joining us in this first hour, though. Stay with us. We'll be right back.